Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, Part 1. Copyright 1957 by Ayn Rand, renewed 1985 by the estate of Ayn Rand. This recording of the reading of Atlas Shrugged was published by arrangement with Curtis Brown Limited and was produced in 1991 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, Part 1. This book is 1,084 pages long and is divided into 30 chapters. It will be read in 3 parts. The following material appears on the end paper of the book. Atlas Shrugged, the astounding story of a man who said that he would stop the motor of the world, and did. Tremendous in scope, breathtaking in its suspense, Atlas Shrugged is unlike any other book you have ever read. It is a mystery story, not about the murder of a man's body, but about the murder and rebirth of man's spirit. Ayn Rand's first novel, We the Living, was published in 1936. With the publication of The Fountainhead in 1943, she achieved a spectacular and enduring success. Miss Rand's unique philosophy, objectivism, has gained a worldwide audience. The fundamentals of her philosophy are set forth in her brilliant novels The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, and in 4 nonfiction books, For the New Intellectual, The Virtue of Selfishness, Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, and The New Left, The Anti-Industrial Revolution. Her Broadway success, Night of January 16th, and the magnificent statement of her artistic credo, The Romantic Manifesto, are also available in signet editions.
Miss Rand wrote a monthly periodical, The Ayn Rand Letter, in which she discussed the meaning of today's events and cultural trends.
About the author. My personal life, says Ayn Rand, is a postscript to my novels. It consists of the sentence, "And I mean it." I have always lived by the philosophy I present in my books, and it has worked for me, as it works for my characters. The concretes differ, the abstractions are the same. I decided to be a writer at the age of 9, and everything I've done was integrated to that purpose. I'm an American by choice and conviction. I was born in Europe, but I came to America because this was the country based on my moral premises, and the only country where one could be fully free to write. I came here alone after graduating from a European college. I had a difficult struggle earning my living at odd jobs until I could make a financial success of my writing. No one helped me, nor did I think at any time that it was anyone's duty to help me. In college I had taken history as my major subject, and philosophy as my special interest. The first, in order to have a factual knowledge of men's past for my future writing. The second, in order to achieve an objective definition of my values. I found that the first could be learned, but the second had to be done by me. I have held the same philosophy I now hold for as far back as I can remember. I've learned a great deal through the years and expanded my knowledge of details, of specific issues, of definitions, of applications, and I intend to continue expanding it. But I have never had to change any of my fundamentals. My philosophy, in essence, is the concept of man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life, with productive achievement as his noblest activity, and reason as his only absolute. The only philosophical debt I can acknowledge is to Aristotle. I most emphatically disagree with a great many parts of his philosophy, but his definition of the laws of logic and of the means of human knowledge is so great an achievement that his errors are irrelevant by comparison. You will find my tribute to him in the titles of the 3 parts of Atlas Shrugged. My other acknowledgement is on the dedication page of this novel. I knew what values of character I wanted to find in a man. I met such a man, and we have been married for 28 years. His name is Frank O'Connor. To all the readers who discovered The Fountainhead and asked me many questions about the wider application of its ideas, I want to say that I'm answering these questions in the present novel, and that The Fountainhead was only an overture to Atlas Shrugged. I trust that no one will tell me that men such as I write about don't exist. That this book has been written and published is my proof that they do. Ayn Rand, 1957. Dedication to Frank O'Connor. Part 1, Non-Contradiction. Chapter 1, The Theme.
Who is John Galt?
The light was ebbing, and Eddie Willers could not distinguish the bum's face. The bum had said it simply, without expression, but from the sunset far at the end of the street, yellow glints caught his eyes, and the eyes looked straight at Eddie Willers, mocking and still, as if the question had been addressed to the causeless uneasiness within him.
"Why did you say that?" asked Eddie Willers, his voice tense. The bum leaned against the side of the doorway. A wedge of broken glass behind him reflected the metal yellow of the sky.
"Why does it bother you?" he asked.
"It doesn't," snapped Eddie Willers. He reached hastily into his pocket. The bum had stopped him and asked for a dime, then had gone on talking as if to kill that moment and postpone the problem of the next. Pleas for dimes were so frequent in the streets these days that it was not necessary to listen to explanations, and he had no desire to hear the details of this bum's particular despair. "Go get your cup of coffee," he said, handing the dime to the shadow that had no face.
"Thank you, sir," said the voice, without interest,
and the face leaned forward for a moment. The face was wind-browned, cut by lines of weariness and cynical resignation. The eyes were intelligent. Eddie Willers walked on, wondering why he always felt it at this time of day. This sense of dread without reason. No, he thought, not dread. There's nothing to fear. Just an immense, diffused apprehension with no source or object. He had become accustomed to the feeling, but he could find no explanation for it. Yet the bum had spoken as if he knew that Eddie felt it, as if he thought that one should feel it, and more, as if he knew the reason. Eddie Willers pulled his shoulders straight in conscientious self-discipline. He had to stop this, he thought. He was beginning to imagine things. Had he always felt it? He was 32 years old. He tried to think back. No, he hadn't. But he could not remember when it had started. The feeling came to him suddenly, at random intervals, and now it was coming more often than ever. It's the twilight, he thought. I hate the twilight. The clouds and the shafts of skyscrapers against them were turning brown like an old painting in oil, the color of a fading masterpiece. Long streaks of grime ran from under the pinnacles down the slender, soot-eaten walls. High on the side of a tower, there was a crack in the shape of a motionless lightning, the length of 10 stories. A jagged object cut the sky above the roofs. It was half a spire, still holding the glow of the sunset. The gold leaf had long since peeled off the other half. The glow was red and still, like the reflection of a fire. Not an active fire, but a dying one, which it is too late to stop. No, thought Eddie Willers. There was nothing disturbing in the sight of the city. It looked as it had always looked. He walked on, reminding himself that he was late in returning to the office. He did not like the task, which he had to perform on his return, but it had to be done. So he did not attempt to delay it, but made himself walk faster. He turned a corner. In the narrow space between the dark silhouettes of 2 buildings, as in the crack of a door, he saw the page of a gigantic calendar suspended in the sky. It was the calendar that the mayor of New York had erected last year on the top of a building, so that citizens might tell the day of the month as they told the hours of the day, by glancing up at a public tower. A white rectangle hung over the city, imparting the date to the men in the streets below. In the rusty light of this evening's sunset, the rectangle said, September 2nd. Eddie Willers looked away. He had never liked the sight of that calendar. It disturbed him in a manner he could not explain or define. The feeling seemed to blend with his sense of uneasiness. It had the same quality. He thought suddenly that there was some phrase,
a kind of quotation that expressed what the calendar seemed to suggest, but he could not recall it. He walked, groping for a sentence that hung in his mind as an empty shape. He could neither fill it nor dismiss it. He glanced back. The white rectangle stood above the roofs, saying in immovable finality, September 2nd. Eddie Willers shifted his glance down to the street, to a vegetable pushcart at the stoop of a brownstone house. He saw a pile of bright gold carrots and the fresh green of onions. He saw a clean white curtain blowing at an open window. He saw a bus turning a corner, expertly steered. He wondered why he felt reassured, and then why he felt the sudden inexplicable wish that these things were not left in the open, unprotected against the empty space above. When he came to Fifth Avenue, he kept his eyes on the windows of the stores he passed. There was nothing he needed or wished to buy, but he liked to see the display of goods, any goods, objects made by men to be used by men. He enjoyed the sight of a prosperous street. Not more than every fourth one of the stores was out of business, its windows dark and empty. He did not know why he suddenly thought of the oak tree. Nothing had recalled it. But he thought of it, and of his childhood summers on the Taggart estate. He had spent most of his childhood with the Taggart children, and now he worked for them, as his father and grandfather had worked for their father and grandfather. The great oak tree had stood on a hill over the Hudson in a lonely spot on the Taggart estate. Eddie Willers, aged 7, liked to come and look at that tree. It had stood there for hundreds of years, and he thought it would always stand there. Its roots clutched the hill like a fist, with fingers sunk into the soil. And he thought that if a giant were to seize it by the top, he would not be able to uproot it, but would swing the hill and the whole of the earth with it, like a ball at the end of a string. He felt safe in the oak tree's presence. It was a thing that nothing could change or threaten. It was his greatest symbol of strength. One night lightning struck the oak tree. Eddie saw it the next morning. It lay broken in half, and he looked into its trunk as into the mouth of a black tunnel. The trunk was only an empty shell. Its heart had rotted away long ago. There was nothing inside, just a thin gray dust that was being dispersed by the whim of the faintest wind. The living power had gone, and the shape it left had not been able to stand without it. Years later, he heard it said that children should be protected from shock, from their first knowledge of death, pain, or fear. But these had never scared him. His shock came when he stood very quietly, looking into the black hole of the trunk. It was an immense betrayal, the more terrible because he could not grasp what it was that had been betrayed. It was not himself, he knew, nor his trust. It was something else. He stood there for a while, making no sound. Then he walked back to the house. He never spoke about it to anyone then or since. Eddie Willers shook his head as the screech of a rusty mechanism changing a traffic light stopped him on the edge of a curb. He felt anger at himself. There was no reason that he had to remember the oak tree tonight. It meant nothing to him any longer, only a faint tinge of sadness, and somewhere within him, a drop of pain, moving briefly and vanishing like a raindrop on the glass of a window, its course in the shape of a question mark. He wanted no sadness attached to his childhood. He loved its memories. Any day of it he remembered now seemed flooded by a still, brilliant sunlight. It seemed to him as if a few rays from it reached into his present. Not rays, more like pinpoint spotlights, that gave an occasional moment's glitter to his job, to his lonely apartment, to the quiet, scrupulous progression of his existence. He thought of a summer day when he was 10 years old. That day in a clearing of the woods, the one precious companion of his childhood told him what they would do when they grew up. The words were harsh and glowing like the sunlight. He listened in admiration and in wonder. When he was asked what he would want to do, he answered at once, "Whatever is right," and added, "You ought to do something great. I mean the two of us together." "What?" she asked. He said, "I don't know. That's what we ought to find out. Not just what you said, not just business and earning a living. Things like winning battles or saving people out of fires or climbing mountains." "What for?" she asked. He said, "The minister said last Sunday that we must always reach for the best within us. What do you suppose is the best within us?"
I don't know. We'll have to find out. She did not answer. She was looking away up the railroad track. Eddie Willer smiled. He had said, "Whatever is right," 22 years ago. He had kept that statement unchallenged ever since. The other questions had faded in his mind. He had been too busy to ask them. But he still thought it self-evident that one had to do what was right. He had never learned how people could want to do otherwise. He had learned only that they did. It still seemed simple and incomprehensible to him. Simple, that things should be right, and incomprehensible that they weren't. He knew that they weren't. He thought of that as he turned a corner and came to the great building of Taggart Transcontinental. The building stood over the street as its tallest and proudest structure. Eddie Willers always smiled at his first sight of it. Its long bands of windows were unbroken, in contrast to those of its neighbors. Its rising lines cut the sky with no crumbling corners or worn edges. It seemed to stand above the years untouched. It would always stand there, thought Eddie Willers. Whenever he entered the Taggart building, he felt relief and a sense of security. This was a place of competence and power. The floors of its hallways were mirrors made of marble. The frosted rectangles of its electric fixtures were chips of solid light. Behind sheets of glass, rows of girls sat at typewriters, the clicking of their keys like the sound of speeding train wheels. And like an answering echo, a faint shudder went through the walls at times, rising from under the building, from the tunnels of the great terminal where trains started out to cross a continent and stopped after crossing it again, as they had started and stopped for generation after generation. Taggart Transcontinental, thought Eddie Willers, from ocean to ocean, the proud slogan of his childhood, so much more shining and holy than any commandment of the Bible. From ocean to ocean, forever, thought Eddie Willers, in the manner of a rededication, as he walked through the spotless halls, into the heart of the building, into the office of James Taggart, president of Taggart Transcontinental. James Taggart sat at his desk. He looked like a man approaching 50 who had crossed into age from adolescence without the intermediate stage of youth. He had a small, petulant mouth and thin hair clinging to a bald forehead. His posture had a limp, decentralized sloppiness, as if in defiance of his tall, slender body, a body with an elegance of line intended for the confident poise of an aristocrat, but transformed into the gawkiness of a lout. The flesh of his face was pale and soft. His eyes were pale and veiled, with a glance that moved slowly, never quite stopping, gliding off and past things in eternal resentment of their existence. He looked obstinate and drained. He was 39 years old. He lifted his head with irritation at the sound of the opening door. "Don't bother me, don't bother me, don't bother me," said James Taggart. Eddie Willers walked toward the desk. "It's important, Jim," he said, not raising his voice. All right, what is it?" Eddie Willers looked at a map on the wall of the office. The map's colors had faded under the glass. He wondered dimly how many Taggart presidents had sat before it, and for how many years. The Taggart Transcontinental Railroad, the network of red lines, slashing the faded body of the country from New York to San Francisco, looked like a system of blood vessels. It looked as if once, long ago, the blood had shot down the main artery, and under the pressure of its own overabundance had branched out at random points running all over the country. One red streak twisted its way from Cheyenne, Wyoming, down to El Paso, Texas, the Rio Norte line of Taggart Transcontinental. New tracing had been added recently, and the red streak had been extended south beyond El Paso. But Eddie Willers turned away hastily when his eyes reached that point. He looked at James Taggart and said, "It's the Rio Norte line." He noticed Taggart's glance moving down to a corner of the desk. "We've had another wreck. Railroad accidents happen every day. Did you have to bother me about that?" "You know what I'm saying, Jim. The Rio Norte is done for. That track is shot down the whole line." "We are getting a new track," Eddie Willers continued as if there had been no answer. "That track is shot. It's no use trying to run trains down there. People are giving up trying to use them. There is not a railroad in the country, it seems to me, that doesn't have a few branches running at a deficit. We're not the only ones. It's a national condition, a temporary national condition.
Eddie stood looking at him silently. What Taggart disliked about Eddie Willers was this habit of looking straight into people's eyes. Eddie's eyes were blue, wide, and questioning. He had blonde hair and a square face, unremarkable except for that look of scrupulous attentiveness, an open, puzzled wonder.
"What do you want?" snapped Taggart.
"I just came to tell you something you had to know because somebody had to tell you.
That we've had another accident?
That we can't give up the Rio Norte line."
James Taggart seldom raised his head. When he looked at people, he did so by lifting his heavy eyelids and staring upward from under the expanse of his bald forehead.
"Who's thinking of giving up the Rio Norte line?" he asked.
"There's never been any question of giving it up. I resent your saying it. I resent it very much.
But we haven't met a schedule for the last 6 months. We haven't completed a run without some sort of breakdown, major or minor. We're losing all our shippers one after another. How long can we last?"
"You're a pessimist, Eddie. You lack faith. That's what undermines the morale of an organization."
"You mean that nothing's going to be done about the Rio Norte line?"
"I haven't said that at all. Just as soon as we get the new track..."
"Jim, there isn't going to be any new track."
He watched Taggart's eyelids move up slowly.
"I've just come back from the office of Associated Steel. I've spoken to Warren Boyle."
"What did he say?"
"He spoke for an hour and a half and did not give me a single straight answer."
"What did you bother him for?
I believe the first order of rail wasn't due for delivery until next month."
"And before that, it was due for delivery 3 months ago."
"Unforeseen circumstances. Absolutely beyond Orrin's control."
"And before that, it was due 6 months earlier."
"Jim, we have waited for Associated Steel to deliver that rail for 13 months.
"What do you want me to do? I can't run Orrin Boyle's business."
"I want you to understand that we can't wait."
Taggart asked slowly, his voice half mocking, half cautious.
"What did my sister say?"
"She won't be back until tomorrow."
"Well, what do you want me to do?"
"That's for you to decide."
"Well, whatever else you say, there's one thing you're not going to mention next, and that's Reardon Steel."
Eddie did not answer at once, then said quietly,
"All right, Jim. I won't mention it."
"Orrin is my friend."
He heard no answer.
"I resent your attitude. Orrin Boyle will deliver that rail just as soon as it's humanly possible. So long as he can't deliver it, nobody can blame us."
"Jim, what are you talking about? Don't you understand that the Rio Norte line is breaking up, whether anybody blames us or not?"
"People would put up with it. They'd have to, if it weren't for the Phoenix Durango."
He saw Eddie's face tighten.
"Nobody ever complained about the Rio Norte line until the Phoenix Durango came on the scene."
"The Phoenix Durango is doing a brilliant job."
"Imagine a thing called the Phoenix Durango competing with Taggart Transcontinental. It was nothing but a local milk line 10 years ago.
It's got most of the freight traffic of Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado now."
Taggart did not answer. "Jim, we can't lose Colorado. It's our last hope. It's everybody's last hope. If we don't pull ourselves together, we'll lose every big shipper in the state to the Phoenix Durango. We've lost the Wyatt oil fields."
"I don't see why everybody keeps talking about the Wyatt oil fields."
"Because Ellis Wyatt is a prodigy who..."
"Damn Ellis Wyatt!"
"Those oil wells," Eddie thought suddenly. "Didn't they have something in common with the blood vessels on the map? Wasn't that the way the red stream of Taggart Transcontinental had shot across the country years ago, a feat that seemed incredible now?" He thought of the oil wells spouting a black stream that ran over a continent almost faster than the trains of the Phoenix Durango could carry it. That oil field had been only a rocky patch in the mountains of Colorado, given up as exhausted long ago. Ellis Wyatt's father had managed to squeeze an obscure living to the end of his days out of the dying oil wells. Now it was as if somebody had given a shot of adrenaline to the heart of the mountain. The heart had started pumping. The black blood had burst through the rocks. "Of course it's blood," thought Eddie Willers, "because blood is supposed to feed, to give life. And that is what Wyatt Oil had done. It had shocked empty slopes of ground
into sudden existence. It had brought new towns, new power plants, new factories to a region nobody had ever noticed on any map. New factories, thought Eddie Willers, at a time when the freight revenues from all the great old industries were dropping slowly year by year. A rich new oil field, at a time when the pumps were stopping in one famous field after another. A new industrial state where nobody had expected anything but cattle and beets. One man had done it, and he had done it in 8 years. This, thought Eddie Willers, was like the stories he had read in school books and never quite believed, the stories of men who had lived in the days of the country's youth. He wished he could meet Ellis Wyatt. There was a great deal of talk about him, but few had ever met him. He seldom came to New York. They said he was 33 years old and had a violent temper. He had discovered some way to revive exhausted oil wells, and he had proceeded to revive them. "Ellis Wyatt is a greedy bastard who's after nothing but money," said James Taggart. "It seems to me that there are more important things in life than making money." "What are you talking about, Jim? What has that got to do with... Besides, he's double-crossed us. We served the Wyatt oil fields for years, most adequately. In the days of Old Man Wyatt, we ran a tank train a week." "These are not the days of Old Man Wyatt, Jim. The Phoenix Durango runs 2 tank trains a day down there, and it runs them on schedule. If he had given us time to grow along with him, he has no time to waste. What does he expect? That we'd drop all our other shippers, sacrifice the interests of the whole country, and give him all our trains? Why, no, he doesn't expect anything. He just deals with the Phoenix Durango. I think he's a destructive, unscrupulous ruffian. I think he's an irresponsible upstart who's been grossly overrated." It was astonishing to hear a sudden emotion in James Taggart's lifeless voice. "I'm not so sure that his oil fields are such a beneficial achievement. It seems to me that he's dislocated the economy of the whole country. Nobody expected Colorado to become an industrial state. How can we have any security or plan anything if everything changes all the time?" "Good God, Jim! Yes, I know he's making money, but that is not the standard, it seems to me, by which one gauges a man's value to society. And as for his oil, he'd come crawling to us, and he'd wait his turn along with all the other shippers, and he wouldn't demand more than his fair share of transportation if it weren't for the Phoenix Durango. We can't help it if we're up against destructive competition of that kind. Nobody can blame us." The pressure in his chest and temples, thought Eddie Willers, was the strain of the effort he was making. He had decided to make the issue clear for once, and the issue was so clear, he thought, that nothing could bar it from Taggart's understanding, unless it was the failure of his own presentation. So he had tried hard, but he was failing, just as he had always failed in all of their discussions. No matter what he said, they never seemed to be talking about the same subject. "Jim, what are you saying? Does it matter that nobody blames us when the road is falling apart?" James Taggart smiled. It was a thin smile, amused and cold. "It's touching, Eddie," he said. "It's touching, your devotion to Taggart Transcontinental. If you don't look out, you'll turn into one of those real feudal serfs. That's what I am, Jim. But may I ask whether it is your job to discuss these matters with me?" "No, it isn't." "Then why don't you learn that we have departments to take care of things? Why don't you report all this to whoever's concerned? Why don't you cry on my dear sister's shoulder?" "Look, Jim, I know it's not my place to talk to you, but I can't understand what's going on. I don't know what it is that your proper advisors tell you, or why they can't make you understand. So I thought I'd try to tell you myself. I appreciate our childhood friendship, Eddie. But do you think that that should entitle you to walk in here unannounced whenever you wish? Considering your own rank, shouldn't you remember that I am president of Taggart Transcontinental?" This was wasted. Eddie Willers looked at him as usual, not hurt, merely puzzled, and asked, "Then you don't intend to do anything about the Rio Norte line?"
"I haven't said that. I haven't said that at all."
Taggart was looking at the map, at the red streak south of El Paso. "Just as soon as the San Sebastian mines get going and our Mexican branch begins to pay off, don't let's talk about that, Jim." Taggart turned.